What to learn from the sinking of the El Faro cargo ship. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And you can now watch the show, too, video on demand with our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls as the investigation into the El Faro tragedy wraps up in Jacksonville. Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, find out how UNF and the Y are teaming up this summer so you and your kids can keep the learning going even when school is out. Plus, a look at St. Augustine's Women's Wednesday speaker series this June. All of that and more ahead. But first, this hour, there is still much to learn about the tragic loss of the El Faro. The El Faro, of course, was the Jacksonville-based cargo ship that sank last October at sea during Hurricane Joaquin, killing all 33 people on board. Last Friday, 2 weeks of hearings wrapped up looking into the cause of the disaster, and it was a sometimes contentious proceeding. One investigator called the sinking a colossal failure of management before he apologized and took back the comment. But investigators do want to confirm what mistakes were made and also explore ways to prevent a similar tragedy from happening again. We can expect at least one more round of hearings on this here in Jacksonville. But what do we know right now about the sinking of the El Faro? And what has this investigation meant for our maritime presence here in Jacksonville? Right now, we welcome Jacksonville attorney and maritime law expert Rod Sullivan. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Always good to have you on the show. And our own WJCT reporter, Ryan Bank. He's been covering the hearings gavel to gavel and joins us with his thoughts as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions and your comments about the investigation into the sinking of the El Faro? What do you want to know about this? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. Rod Sullivan, let's begin with you. Emotional and sometimes tense hearings, 2 weeks worth, wrapped up Friday. We could expect another round, but in the main right now, what has been the outcome of these public hearings into this tragedy?
Well, you know, the very first 2 weeks of the hearings were held back in March, and they were very scripted, and TOTE got to put its best foot forward and choose its best witnesses, and they were very impressive. This second 2 weeks of hearing was unscripted and unplanned, and therefore it went from excruciatingly dull to very, very interesting in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. And there was some drama, some theater to this right?
There was. You know, the highest ranking representative in the TOTE organization testified on Thursday. And quite frankly, he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. some of the things that he said was, you know, this was an accident, nothing we could do to anticipate it. And when the families heard this, they were already upset. And then he came across with this comment. He said, the proof is in the pudding. Well, everybody really was upset at that. And I mean, it's sort of like saying, look at all the people we haven't killed on all the voyages that haven't sunk.
Uh-huh.
Well, during lunch, one of the sons of one of the decedents who's from this area in Gainesville went out and got a tray full of little pudding cups. And I brought you some pudding because this has become sort of the symbol of the El Faro family.
These little portable pudding cups.
These little
you brought a
cups.
Few here to the studio.
Yeah, I did. And he gave one to everybody, NTSB investigators, Coast Guard investigators, TOTE people. But it became the symbol of the families. You're going to tell us that, you know, the fact that you haven't had other accidents where ships sank means that our families and our loved ones, you know, we just have to accept it as these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
It was an insensitive comment for the TOTE executive to make, and it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Well, after that was when the lead investigator for the NTSB came out with this comment and said, listen, this has been a colossal failure in management. And everybody was sort of stunned that he said this. And then we have to explain that he walked this comment back on Friday.
Right.
And you happen to wonder why. Well, the reason is he is the lead investigator, but he doesn't speak for the NTSB. He creates a report. The NTSB decides what the conclusions are going to be. So he said, look, I asked an insensitive question yesterday. I apologize. I don't want you to think that the NTSB has come to any conclusions because it has not. But I really think that his question was almost a visceral reaction to the testimony of the TOTE executive who I think offended a lot of people.
We'll go to your calls about the investigation into the sinking of the Alfaro in just a moment. The number to join us, 549-2937. Ryan Bank, as you covered these hearings, you heard a lot of testimony about allegations that safety procedures were given short shrift in favor of making the captain's cargo ship delivery on time. What did we learn?
I mean, that was at least where it seemed like the investigators were going with their questioning. As Rod said, they were very, very careful, very scripted during the first round of hearings. Those first 2 weeks, it seemed like they had the entire script written out. But I think as the questions grew more and more specific and they went into the programming that the ship had available to track weather, the programming the ship had available to kind of make sure that the ship was balanced while they were loading it, the issues with the ship's engine room, and we saw some conflicting testimony about that, about poor safety ratings and inspections on the boilers. All of this seemed to be hinting at the fact that this 40-year-old ship should have been retired a long time ago before, mm-hmm. you know, it took this voyage directly into the path of a hurricane. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was an interview that Rod had done with Sid Hoskinson last week, where he said the biggest things here were the biggest revelations here were the fact that the ship was in the condition that it was, and it was still allowed to sail in the way that it did. I mean, as it's been said many times, a hurricane is going to stress every single part of the ship. And when you have all these small deficiencies, arguably, added up together and you're going into a Cat 4.
But Rod, even if the ship had been in perfect mint condition, was it still a bad call to send it into the eye of that storm? Yeah. I think that's the question most laymen have.
Yeah, clearly the captain did make some bad decisions, and he made it based upon, quite frankly, a hurricane track, which was never correct from day one. And we got to hear from the National Hurricane Center how they create these tracks. They take 14 different models, and they average them all together. Well, in this case, 13 of the 14 models were wrong, and it showed the storm was going to turn to the north. And only one of them showed that it was going to continue on its relentless path west, which is what it did. Well, the captain, I think, in reliance upon the belief that the storm was going to turn north, said, I'm going to shoot south of it, and that turned out to be a bad decision.
And hurricane season, we need to point out, begins tomorrow.
Right.
How has this tragedy, do you think, affected the maritime industry in this area in terms of how they gauge the effects, the potential dangers of storms?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. That's a really big question. And as you said, we still probably have another round of hearings. We don't know yet if they will be able to recover the voyage data recorder, which will give us a clue as to what happened during the ship's final moments. But I think it's obvious that the information that they were working with to track these storms was not only incorrect, but it was late and inadequate. And they have no explanation as to why the ship got, I think it was, what, 10 hours, 11 hours 20, late?
21.
21 hours
one of those reports
late.
Was 20 hours. Oh, yeah. So anyway, the weather information was fascinating. I wanted to pick up on a point that Ryan mentioned about it being an old ship, because I don't think people understand what the effect of that is. There's something called the Alternative Compliance Program, which is now run by private entities. Mm-hmm. And they did an inspection on the boilers, and they asked the inspector, you brought this up to 100% of design operating pressure during your test. And she said, yes. But the regulations say you bring it up to 125%. Why didn't you do that? And she says, it's my discretion. And I think what was the subtext there is, this is a 40-year-old ship. You subject it to 125% of design pressure and something's coming loose. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to do that. And so that's the difference between the regulations that are in place and established by the Coast Guard and the alternative compliance program and the discretion it gives to these investigators.
We'll go to your call. Oh, 1 second, Ryan. I just want to get Chuck on the air as we go to your calls about the Alfaro tragedy and what we know right now. 549-2937 to give us a call. Chuck is in Jacksonville. Hi, Chuck. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Everything that's said, I think whether it's a new boat or an old boat, you have to be proactive, worst-case scenario, which means lifeboats. And the last time we discussed this on your show, I looked at the lifeboats. There are lifeboats that look like space shuttles. They hold 5, 10, 15 people. They can fall. You can get in these lifeboats and fall 7 stories, go into the water nose first. So that means they're probably going, 70, 80 miles an hour when they hit the water. Those lifeboats could stand serious, serious weather if they can fall 7 stories. How much do they cost? And why aren't they proactive, worst case scenario? And should they have those on those boats?
All right, thanks,
Chuck. I'd like to address that because they have not announced what the subject of the next set of hearings is going to be, but I'm hopeful it's going to be topics like he discussed. Mm-hmm. 33 people went into the water. No one survived. That should not happen. Now, new ships built since 1986 have these free-fall lifeboats that'll save people, and I think they're going to have more discussions about this.
What about the Coast Guard's rescue response? Were they too little, too late? Did that come out in the hearings?
I think what happened was they had a response team and planes that were extremely far away from where their ship was. On top of that, they were working with a new ship tracking program that was very glitchy, that oftentimes had them have to sit down and replot a ship's position manually with the map and other instruments. So I think there could have been a quicker response if they had a working system, but I'm not sure if that would have saved the crew.
And Rod, we also learned during these hearings that a former captain for Totes says that he was fired after raising safety concerns about a sister ship to the El Faro.
Yeah,
what about that?
That was a very, emotional and surprising part of the testimony, because this captain, Jack Hearn, I believe his name is, spent an hour or two testifying very favorably toward Tote. And then they came to the point of, well, what caused you to leave Tote? And he said, I reported to Tote that there were holes in hold number 2 that needed to be fixed, and we needed to report it to the Coast Guard. And Tote disagreed. And so consequently, it didn't get repaired. We went and made another trip north before it finally got addressed to the Coast Guard. And after that, I was sort of persona non grata. Well, Tote was very upset about this testimony, and they actually asked for a recess in the hearings. And then after the recess was over, they said, we have no questions. But then the captain's attorney said, weren't you actually fired for 46 kilos of cocaine coming on board the ship while you were captain? Like, what did this have to do with anything?
Whoa.
But that he had to admit that that was right. That was what actually was the incident that resulted in his actual termination from Tote.
We want your calls on the sinking of the El Faro. As 2-week-long hearings into the tragedy wrapped up Friday in Jacksonville, 549-2937 to join us. What are your questions about this? Terry is in Jacksonville. Hi, Terry. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Great, thanks.
I actually have 2 questions. The first is, was the hull of the El Faro ever lengthened or extended? It looked like it was very weak in the middle. And the second was, does Tote rely on private weather forecasting services, which seem to be very prevalent in the maritime industry and very accurate?
Okay, yeah. Thanks for those questions.
I believe there was definitely, we saw there was definitely some work that was happening on the El Faro to make it ready for the Alaska trade. Part of that was some work on the hull. On top of that, the weather tracking system was a private weather tracking system. It used information that was available from the National Weather Service, and it combined it together to form these tracks. However, the actual way of getting that information and getting those tracks seems a little outdated for a day and time when we can bring up weather reports on our phone almost instantly.
And will this tragedy force changes, at least in that protocol, Rod?
You know, the thing is that these weather tracking services are great when you're out at sea and you don't have internet access.
But yeah.
One of the things your listeners can take from this whole tragedy is, if you have internet access, you have the best weather data that's available to you. And the same thing with ships. While the El Faro was halfway down the Bahamas, it still has internet access. Someplace after that, it loses the signal. But you can get very good weather data from the internet. If you're relying upon these other private weather services, they're going to be more outdated than the information you can get from the internet.
I would also like to mention specifically how they get this information. These tracks are combined and averaged, as Rod mentioned. Then they're sent as an emailed package to the ship. Then the captain or...
It's an aggregate of lots of different reports, right?
Right.
In effect.
In effect, it's an aggregate. But it's an email package. Think about opening up a PDF via email or opening up a RAR file or something like that and using this proprietary program to then view this weather track. So there's a lot of time in between.
Mm-hmm. And conditions can change rapidly.
Conditions can change,
sure.
As we saw with the hurricane.
549-2937. Kevin is on the road. Hey, Kevin. Good morning. Hey. How's your week? Is your work week off to a good start?
It's off to a great start. I'm out of school, so woohoo. We're heading to Hitchcock and Springs. But a while back, I read the Susan Casey book called The Waves. And in that book, she starts off with it. On average, we lose one tanker a week at sea every year. I just wanted to know your expert comments on that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the proof is in the pudding. We lose a lot of boats.
Yeah. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, these are mostly foreign ships that are sinking. They tend to be older ships. They tend to be run in countries which don't have regulations and inspections the way we do in the United States.
And that brings me to a follow-up about the Jones Act.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to our audience a little bit about the Jones Act and how that interacts with this tragedy and all the discussion around that?
Yeah, well, the Jones Act was initially enacted so we would have a core. First of all, the U.S. Merchant Marine has a difficulty competing with foreign ships. The Department of Defense believes it needs a core of U.S. ships in order to provide for moving troops and equipment during time of war. So the Jones Act was passed saying that all coastwise traffic in the United States and all traffic between the United States and Hawaii and then the United States and Puerto Rico needs to be carried on U.S. ships with U.S. crews. Now, that has been a tremendous boon for Jacksonville because most Puerto Rico cargo leaves here out of Jacksonville to Puerto Rico and behind and back. The Jones Act is not free. Who pays for it? Citizens in Puerto Rico pay for it. Citizens in Hawaii pay for it. And people who have...
And Puerto Ricans don't like the Jones Act, we should point out. Yeah.
I can't blame them. I mean, one of the reasons prices are so much higher in Puerto Rico and in Alaska is because of the Jones Act. The flip side, of course, is provides a lot of employment for U.S. Seamen. It provides a lot of employment at Crowley and a lot of employment at Tote and other companies which service the Jones Act cargo. So it's a trade-off.
In light of the tragedy and allegations that the company was, it's been alleged, cutting safety corners to handle a very thin profit margin because of this very aggressive foreign competition, what are your thoughts about the future of the Jones Act in the wake of this tragedy?
Well, John McCain and some other senators have been very active in trying to get rid of the Jones Act for years. And it's like any subsidy or any protectionism. It's very difficult. Once it's in there, once it's entrenched, there's a large group of people desiring to see it stay in place, and there's a very small, diffuse group of people who want to see it done away with. So it becomes a political question more than it does a legal question.
And I think the Jones Act, as it relates to just overall regulations, when it comes to the oversight of these shipping companies, is important to mention. I wanted to circle back to the alternate compliance program. We also figured out through these hearings that a very, very tiny portion of those safety inspections conducted through the alternate compliance program are actually reviewed by the Coast Guard. And of those, that small percentage that were double-checked by the Coast Guard, a much larger percentage of them, I think it was as high as, was it 35%, they found problems. So I think this just shows that there needs to be stricter oversight, kind of similar to what we see with the airline industry.
Let's go to Tom in Jacksonville. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Yes, ma'am. How are you doing?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
I don't know why John McCain wants to overturn the Jones Act. He lives in Arizona. There's no rivers or waterways in Arizona. I think someone's paying him to do this. He keeps throwing these bills and they'll pretend the Jones Act. I worked with the crew on the Elfall. In fact, you're talking about that captain that was busted for cocaine?
Uh-huh.
The sister ship, the El Morro, I worked on that ship too.
Uh-huh.
The crew on the Elfall, many of them were on the El Morro when that happened. They followed that job and kept that job for years. I mean, they're good people.
What are your thoughts? Knowing what you know, you worked in this environment. What are your thoughts about all those?
My thoughts are that if the ship had a 15-degree list, so say it's in 40-foot seas and it's rolling, back and forth, it probably rolled over and probably nobody got off alive. And even what a lifeboats wouldn't have made that big a difference, although the lifeboats were old.
Okay. Thanks for that insight, Tom.
Yeah. When the ship lost its power, it had no control over its heading into the waves and probably got in what's called the trough. The ship is with the waves coming straight on the side, so it rolls the maximum amount, and they had no power. They probably rolled over, the survivors probably didn't last very long.
Did you know any of the people that were killed on that ship, Tom?
Yes, ma'am. I worked with more than a few of them.
Wow.
The good people. The second mate, I was always on her watch. She was the third mate when I worked with her.
Okay.
And JJ was a real good guy. There's a lot of good people on that boat.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for them.
Sure. Well, Tom, thanks for calling. Thank you, ma'am. Go ahead, Rod.
Yeah, well, if you look at the photographs taken undersea of the El Faro, it tells a completely different story. And quite frankly, I'm going to choke up if I talk about this. But what you see is you see the people desperately trying to get off of the El Faro. They had lots of time. They took a pilot ladder from the main deck up to the embarkation deck and rigged it because they were trying to climb down into the lifeboats. They were rigging lines over the sides.
We know this how? From the black box.
From looking at the pictures, where, you know, if you see the pilot ladder up five decks, you say to yourself, well, how did it get up there?
I see. Okay.
You have lines tied to the railings. You have all sorts of things that were done so that people could lower themselves into the water. So this did not happen quickly. These guys, men and women, both had a lot of time to think about how to rescue themselves and simply were not able to do it.
Let's go to Sue in Mandarin. Hey, Sue, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Well, I would speak to some of the things they've just talked about, and that was that they did try to make an escape, but could not. And the question is, one thing we were being told is that they were working on the boilers even while they were underway. If the power failed, just as you've just said, and the power is gone completely, this ship is going to broach, it's going to roll, and so... Previously, they have talked about modifications to the ship and additions to the length of it. And in previous instances, that has been cited in failures of freighters that the hull was not intact. Mm. So, you know, you've got to applaud the crew for doing the best they could. And they were all professionals. They really seemed to be doing their job well. But they had a failing piece of equipment to deal
yeah.
with.
Yeah, thanks, Sue.
Well, let's address two things there. Yes, the ship was lengthened 90 feet in about 1996 or so, and lengthened ships do have a higher rate of failure than non-lengthened ships. Frank Pusateri's son was the chief engineer on board there, and one of his comments was, if this ship was going down, my son was at the engine room to the very last minute trying to start it up again, and I wouldn't doubt that. The engineers would have been the last ones off, and they would have been the ones trying furiously to restart the engines and get the ship on its way.
Lomax is on the south side. Hi, Lomax. How are you?
Are you fine? When this all began, did I hear that this captain was a my way or the highway type person, and he ignored the commands from the shoreline?
No, he didn't get any command from the shoreline. That's actually one of the complaints.
Listen to your tape, sir, at the beginning of the incident. Listen to your tapes. Thank you.
Well, what did we hear at the beginning of the tapes? Oh, he hung up. What did we hear at the beginning of the tapes?
Well, I think he's referring to Captain Davidson, but I think what we've seen with the questioning here through the hearings is that Davidson was waiting to make a call. I mean, he couldn't get a hold of the person ashore. He was trying to get through to a tow representative to tell them he was leaving voicemail saying, you know, hey, we're in an emergency situation. We need guidance and we need help. And, you know, only a little while later, the ship sank. So
it's painful to listen to Captain Davidson's call to the call center, because it's not a call center staffed by maritime people. It's by people who answer phones. And the woman says, can you spell El Faro for me, please? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you mind if I put you on hold? You know, here the ship is sinking. And she's saying, can I put you on hold while I get somebody else?
Jeez.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, it is painful to listen and read through the testimony. And the only silver lining, as you both have reported, is that perhaps some better protocols might come out of this tragedy. What do you both think will be the long-term ramifications of this maritime tragedy?
I can only say what I hope and what I think the families hope come out of this. I think they hope that... At the beginning of these hearings, Captain Neubauer, who's been heading the Marine Board of Investigation, said that the point of this is to prevent any such tragedies like this, do their best to prevent any such tragedies like this from ever happening again. And I think that that's at the core of what these families want. They don't want to see, another 33 families mourning lost sons and daughters and aunts and uncles and fathers and mothers, and having to go through this just excruciating minute-by-minute process, kind of figuring out exactly how this ship sank. And I
sure.
think one of the ways to do that is to increase the oversight of what ships go out there.
Rod?
I think you're going to see two things. I think you're going to see a tightening up of the alternative compliance program and more spot checks and audits of the alternative compliance program surveys. The other thing is the unaddressed topic here, and that's life-saving. How are we going to create suits and ships and lifeboats that are going to enable people to survive a tragedy like that in the future? And that question hasn't been addressed at any of these hearings, and hopefully the next 2 weeks of hearing will address those topics.
As we continue to follow, we appreciate both of you giving your insights this morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you,
Melissa.
We were joined by Jacksonville attorney and maritime analyst Rod Sullivan and our own reporter Ryan Bank, who covered the El Faro hearings. Well, later in the hour, find out why the fiercest women of the First Coast are drawing big crowds to a unique speaker series in St. Augustine. And up next, how you and your kids can keep the learning going this summer, even after school is out. Back in a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Hillary Clinton is under pressure after a State Department report criticized her use of a private email server. What's in the report, potential security risks, and whether it could affect Secretary Clinton's bid for the White House.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
WJCT's Great Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. The bidding begins June 2nd and continues through June 13th. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Jazz, the Great American Songbook, and your favorite oldies on Relax Radio at midnight, only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed.
Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, just because summer break is almost here doesn't mean the kids or the adults have to stop learning. A recent partnership between the YMCA, Florida's First Coast, and UNS Division of Continuing Education is providing a great opportunity this summer. It's called Learn Jacksonville. Valerie Murphy is Assistant Director of Continuing Education at UNF. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, Felina Martin, Director of Healthy Living Innovations with the YMCA of the First Coast. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And what a great partnership. It makes sense.
It absolutely does.
How did this all come about?
Yeah, we're very excited about the partnership, actually. It came about, you know, you have those dreams sometimes at 2 in the morning, and you're like, wow, will this take place? Can we do something like this?
I think of a lot of things at 2 in the morning, too, yeah.
Well, it was one of
most
those.
Most of them don't actually come to pass, though, but this is good. This actually happened.
Exactly, which makes it really exciting. But the why, we're looking at making sure the community is aware that we're more than just gym and swim. We're really mind, body, and spirit, and keeping the mind healthy is very important to us.
Right.
And so in thinking of that, we're looking at lifelong learning and enrichment for our members and expanding it out into the community as well and thinking, how can we do that when we're not experts in that field? And so we went to what we felt was the best in the business to see if we can bring that education to the Y and out into the community. So we sought out working with UNF.
Wow. So there are 17 classes. They're already underway. Everything from foreign language classes to kayaking lessons.
Yes.
Is that right?
That is correct. And the classes started in May. The summer semester goes through August, and this will be something that we continue, you know, forever.
And how is UNF bringing all of its resources to bear to make this a success?
Yes. Learn Jacksonville has been in existence since 2008, so I just reached out. Felina and I worked together to decide what kind of classes we wanted. So I reached out to my instructors who currently teach at UNF, and that's how we got everything underway.
Very nice. And what are some of the classes people can take?
We've got anything from digital photography to introduction to French. We've got how to improve your memory, kayaking, as you mentioned before, attracting abundance, crash course in screenwriting. There's several different courses.
Wow, runs the gamut.
Yes, absolutely.
And these are being offered at five branch-wise around
five
town.
Locations. So we have our Williams location on Mandarin, San Jose Boulevard. We also have Flagler, and then which is on Old St. Augustine Road. Our Arlington branch is fantastic, a large size branch on Atlantic Boulevard. Mm-hmm. Brooks YMCA, which is right around from the town center. So go shopping and come and take your class, or take your class and go shopping. And then last but not least is Yates, also Winston on Riverside Avenue for those who live in maybe the Avondale Riverside area.
These are $25 a class and up, affordable,
yes.
and even less if you're a Y member.
Right. So Y members do receive 15% off, but it is open to the community to be able to come in and enjoy these classes. The vision was that this would be accessible to all and available to all for those who may have transportation limitations to go out to UNF. We're really making this convenient and bringing mm-hmm. the education to you.
This is nice for the summer, too, that families can do some of these with their kids, it
Absolutely.
Sounds like.
Absolutely. We don't really have any age restrictions.
Yeah.
I've had kids take a gardening class with their parents. So,
nice.
Yes, it is. There is no age restriction anywhere from 8 to 80 or 90, actually. Yes.
Right. What are the most popular?
Kayak.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to learn how to kayak and use that digital camera that they have purchased and sitting on the shelf.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, one of the things, too, that's really important to us, as I mentioned about the mind and keeping it stimulated, is we've noticed there's been studies on dementia and Alzheimer's, and the lack of continually improving yourself and learning has an impact on your cognition and memory. And so this, again, is extremely important that you're continuing to learn and develop yourself. And it goes beyond just you working maybe the 9 to 5. When you learn a foreign language, it's stimulating different parts of the brain. And all of that is extremely important, so that prevents that onset of any Alzheimer's or dementia.
And learnjacksonville.com is the website where people can go, right? Not too late to register?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So and there's also a first, the YMCA website as well.
Right,
okay.
/UNF. So First Coast YMCA /UNF. Or if you've got questions that you want to ask someone before you sign up, then 904-265-1775 is the number to call. And we'll help you and go through the descriptions for you if you've got questions. So lots of great information and lots of great classes.
It is a great opportunity for this summer through Learn Jacksonville. 17 classes across the city, very affordable and fun, as the YMCA of the First Coast and UNF team up. Go online, register now. And ladies, thanks for bringing this to the public and letting us share it with our listeners. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Felina Martin is Director of Healthy Living Innovations at the YMCA. Valerie Murphy, Assistant Director of Continuing Education at UNF. Again, that website, either go to the YMCA's website or go to learnjacksonville.com. And we are back in a moment.
Next time on The World, a young woman escaped the war in Syria, only to confront discrimination in Europe. On a train through Austria, fellow passengers requested that refugees be removed.
So I decided not to speak any Arabic or any Kurdish, so they will not suspect that I might be a refugee.
She says never again will she hide who she is. Her story on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls' Day Out, Saturday, September 17th, Hyatt Hotel. The day will include great national and local speakers that will inspire and empower you to live your life to the fullest. Tickets are $40. Do not miss out. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America is a multi-platform public media initiative that provides a deeper understanding of the impact of poverty on American society. Tune in to the PBS NewsHour weeknights at 7 on WJCT-TV for compelling stories of individuals and organizations addressing such issues. And log on to chasingthedreamproject.org. Funding for this initiative is provided by the JPB Foundation and Ford Foundation. Local funding provided by Wells Fargo.
Spend some time in the square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/the square.
Welcome back to the show. Well, she's a former Mayo Clinic executive and a renowned community leader. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record talks with Madeline Scales Taylor.
Madeline Scales Taylor knows people. For almost 40 years, she managed workforce development for companies including Saks Fifth Avenue, Melville Corporation, and May Company Stores. The St. Louis native moved to Jacksonville in 1989 and soon joined Mayo Clinic, where she chaired the Department of Human Resources and established the Community Affairs Initiatives. She retired in 2009, but her community leadership continues. Madeline Scales Taylor, welcome to First Coast Success.
Well, thank you, Karen.
You've been a mainstay in Jacksonville's community affairs for almost 30 years now. What drew you to become a leader in the community?
Wow, that's a long story. I came from a family that gave back to the community. My father integrated the fire department in 1950 in St. Louis, Missouri. And my grandfather, who was a minister, was very instrumental in getting banks to make loans to African Americans for mortgages and business loans, and led sit-ins at several of the banks in St. Louis. So we kind of just grew up knowing that we had a responsibility to give back to our communities. I can remember my mother saying, as she would send me to the neighborhood store, "Now you go across the street and ask Miss Cecilia if she needs anything." So it just became a way of life for my family.
Talk about working with Mayo Clinic. What all did you do with Mayo? Because you were there for many years.
Yes, I was, almost 18 years. I started off in human resources. They were looking for someone who had a background in human resources as a generalist. I started there and helped them to set up their recruitment activities. We grew the organization from 500 employees to about 4,000 when I left Human Resources. And after that, I made the transition over to Community Affairs.
And you led the Community Affairs initiatives for 5,000 employees.
Yes, and that was an exciting time. We had to identify ways that Mayo could become more engaged in the Jacksonville community because we knew that we had a responsibility to assist the city to become better. And that was an exciting time for me, getting employees engaged and involved in initiatives that were going on and getting us engaged with organizations like the Heart Association and the Cancer Association. And while I was there, the 26.2 with Donna started. So it was an exciting time. It was very exciting.
Well, you have been deeply involved in the community through Mayo Clinic, but also through your own efforts because you serve on a lot of boards and you remain involved. What are some of the significant observations that you have about issues that the community should address?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Jacksonville is a community made up of some wonderfully passionate individuals. I mean, individuals who really love this city, either because they were born here or because they migrated here and they saw the beauty of this city. I've seen individuals really take a caring attitude about the issues, and we do have issues. Issues of education, issues of housing, issues of haves and have-nots. But I also am encouraged by individuals who have taken an active interest in making this a better place. I think of the Weavers, and I think what wonderful individuals who have taken their time, their talents, and their treasures and really invested them in this city. And I just think that individuals and organizations are really looking for ways to make this a better place. We've got a lot of work to do, though.
Well, how do you choose what you're going to focus on?
Well, I look for organizations that I can become passionate about. Doesn't have to be a large organization. Often it's a small organization. And I look at how they're making an impact. I look at who they're serving. And I look at how they collaborate with others. Because I don't think we can ever make change alone or in a vacuum. We have to look for ways that we can come together around issues and lift those issues up and then bring the resources, both human resources and financial resources, to make a change. And I think the city does a really good job. As I said, there's still a lot of work to be done, but there's hope. There's hope.
And talking about economic development and job creation, with your background in human resources and economic development, what suggestions do you have for the city on how they should go about doing this?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert in that area at all. But I would say that I think education is the key issue. We have got to do a better job with our K through 12 education. I think that you put money behind those things that you believe in. And we've got to stop touting the fact that we have low taxes. I just firmly believe that. Because we will not be successful as a city until we grapple with and really provide quality education for all of the young people in this city. Additionally, I think that we've got to look at ways to bring young adults back to Jacksonville. We're not doing a very good job there. When individuals graduate from high school and if they go off to college or if they go into other jobs or the military, they talk about leaving this place. They don't talk about coming back home. So we've got to make Jacksonville a place where our young people want to return and want to make a difference. Because those folks who are my age, you know, we're not the ones to do it. They're the ones who are really going to impact change. So we've got to get them back.
That is Madeline Scales Taylor. You can read the complete transcript of Karen's talk with her in today's Daily Record. We'll be right back.
Today's First Coast Success was brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Goodbye, Miami. Hello, Ferguson, says new top cop Delrish Moss.
To believe that Delrish Moss comes here with a magic answer is a unique, actually a naive view. I think that the answers lie in Ferguson.
The chief in Ferguson looks for answers far from his former gig among the palm trees. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's called Women's Wednesdays, a unique speaker series in St. Augustine featuring some of the fiercest women of the First Coast. Kelly Youngs, the founder of She is Fierce and Women's Wednesdays, is here now with a look at who's coming up this summer. You're kicking things off later this week with none other than Donna Orender. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Melissa, for having me. I am honored to be here. You know, this is my favorite show.
Oh, well, we're honored to have you. You know, and I was excited. I think I was your first speaker in this series.
You were. We had our premiere last year.
Right.
And you were our absolute first speaker ever, and you kicked it off so beautifully.
Well,
I think I set the tone.
And ever since, it's been nothing but success. You have these events on Wednesday night at the Treasury, the old bank building in downtown historic St. Augustine. It's an incredible setting. People can come in, get a drink, and hear a great talk.
Yeah, it's an incredible night. This year, Bozard Lincoln is hosting our amazing Women's Wednesdays events. It's at the Treasury. You saw it, but it's this glamorous venue with columns. They have the beautiful vault bar. This year, we're adding in tons of networking, so we have a lot more going on this year. We have our incredible speakers who are inspiring, but we also have a Girlfriend's Night Out by Bozard Lincoln, where people can win Lincoln for the night and free VIP tickets. We have power networking, where women have the opportunity to connect with women leaders in the community who they might not normally have an excuse to connect with. And then just lots of fun activities and things to do.
You came up with this idea some years ago, and from the germ of that, you've really grown it into a real addition, I think, to the types of things that are available in the historic district of St. Augustine, but they draw from not just St. Augustine.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. Yeah, I mean, She is Fierce. I had this idea years ago, but we launched in February of last year. It started as a website, then we started the Women's Wednesday series, and now we have almost 200 members around the world, so in 7 different countries. And then our Women's Wednesday series last year had 1,200 women attend. So we're looking for similar, hopefully, numbers this year.
And you want a big turnout for Donna Orender's appearance, which is coming up on June 1st. What's going to be happening?
Yeah, Donna is incredible. I know she's been on your show many times. She's the former president of the WNBA. She worked her way up at PGA Tour for 17 years. She has an incredible story of, I think, resilience that we all have to kind of get to that level of success. And she's going to bring her personal story of inspiration. And I think that's what's unique about our speakers and what you shared last year, that we don't just have people telling you about their business or telling you how you should live your life. They're sharing their personal stories, what they had to overcome, and also, you know, how they kind of got to that place where they're able to come on stage and inspire others.
And you've got some amazing speakers coming up after Donna. Millionaire mentor Stephanie Nikolich, Snowden McFall, Inc. Magazine Entrepreneur of the Year finalist, New York Times best-selling romance novelist Brenda Jackson. She is Jacksonville's own.
I am so excited to have Brenda as one of our speakers. And our final one is Cindy Chaconis, who's the founder of Pink Up the Pace, who's actually a St. Augustine native, a cancer survivor, and just an all-around amazing group of women. Each with their own unique story. They all have different backgrounds, but they all have something special to say.
How have you gone about the task of picking speakers for this series?
Well, you know, it's been a tough challenge. And actually, this year it was a lot tougher because last year I was going out to women that I found inspiring and saying, hey, can you please do this for me? And nobody really knew what it was.
Right.
But this year, everyone knows what it is and people are excited
to be a part of it. People are asking to be part of it.
Yeah. So this year it's been a different kind of challenge where I've had to say, no, I can't have you this year. Can I have you do something else? Which is a nice problem to have.
Yeah. And so people need to mark their calendars for the kickoff on June 1st at the Treasury in St. Augustine. How can people be part of this?
They can go to our website. Our website is sheisfiercehq.com. Or to get info directly about Women's Wednesdays, they can actually go to womenswednesdays.com, and it will take them to all the info. Tickets are available on Eventbrite, but that's the easiest way to do it. It's womenswednesdays.com.
Come on out, have a drink, hear some great inspiring talk, and network with women that you want to know. Kelly Youngs has put this all together. So impressive, so fierce, I must say. Thanks for being here, and have fun.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I'm very grateful.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. Michelle Corum is running the board this morning. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Our podcasts are available at iTunes and Stitcher, and you can watch the show with our partners, TVJax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, Hillary Clinton is under pressure after a State Department report criticized her use of a private email server. What's in the report, potential security risks, and whether it could affect Secretary Clinton's bid for the White House. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.